This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Dr. Robert Daroff. Today is November 11, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Dr. Daroff is joining me from his office in Cleveland, Ohio. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Why don't we begin, if you don't mind, by telling me a little bit of biographical information about yourself, when and where you were born.
I was born in New York, went to school in New York except for 2 years in military school at Riverside Military Academy in the 9th and 10th grade. By the way, I was born in 1936.
Okay.
And we lived in Forest Hills, Long Island, which is part of the borough of Queens. After my second year in high school, the 10th grade, I was selected to attend college at the as part of a experimental program for bright young kids at the University of Chicago. So I spent, it was 1952-53 as a freshman at the University of Chicago.
Okay.
It was a very interesting experience. I roomed with Carl Sagan, the astronomist, during the summer.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I transferred to the University of Pennsylvania the next year and actually graduated from Penn. Chicago, socially, I was 15 when I was accepted. It was academically very, very, it was an excellent academic experience, but socially I didn't think I was maturing. So I transferred to a more traditional school, Penn, graduated in, and then during my undergraduate years I was editor-in-chief of the Daily Pennsylvanian, which was during my senior year I was editor-in-chief. I worked on the newspaper all 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
That turned out to be a pivotal experience in terms of my career because I've written numerous papers and I've been the editor of a major neurological journal over the years. At any rate,
right. Yes, sir.
I graduated undergraduate in 1957, attended Penn Medical School, graduated in 61, then did an internship at Philadelphia and went to Yale for my neurology residency. And that's sort of when Vietnam starts because at the time there was a doctor draft.
Right.
And the worst thing that could happen to a young physician, I thought, was to be drafted right out of right after finishing medical school and then being stuck in some induction station doing rectals and checking for hernias.
Sure.
Which really wouldn't be a good experience. So the Army had a plan called the Berry Plan, named after an Army Colonel, Frank Berry,
mm-hmm.
In which it was not the Army, it was all the military services. They would, once someone was accepted for residency training in their fourth year or their last year of medical school, they could apply to the Berry Plan, and if accepted, the plan would allow you to finish all your training, and then you'd have an obligate 2-year experience.
Okay.
As a physician in the specialty. So it would be a valid educational experience because you'd be practicing your specialty,
mm-hmm.
distinct from going in as a general medical officer. You could select any of the services, Army, Navy, Air Force. For some reason, I selected the Army.
Okay.
I don't have to go into that unless you want to.
Well, if you don't mind, that was one.
That's fine. I selected the Army, number one. I get seasick.
Uh-huh.
But I knew I wouldn't be on a ship. But the problem with the Navy Medical Corps is you may get assigned to the Marines. And everyone knew being assigned to the Marines was kind of yucky because they didn't like comfort. They felt more comfortable in uncomfortable circumstances. So
right.
The Navy was out for me. The Air Force, there wasn't a major war at the time, so I wasn't thinking about war. The Air Force, I'm thinking about bases stateside.
Sure.
The Air Force were in North Dakota, South Dakota, godforsaken places, Iceland, you know. And so I picked the Army.
Okay.
So I signed up for the Army Barry Plan, and indeed, I was, when I finished my residency in June 65, I was going to enter active duty.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things happened. One, during the middle of my residency, my chief, the professor at Yale, got a call from the Public Health Service asking whether he had a resident who was graduating who'd be willing to spend 1 year in Guam and then the second year at the NIH in Bethesda.
Mm-hmm.
I told him that I couldn't because I was assigned to the Berry Plan. He called the Public Health Service, and they said, well, we can get him out of the Berry Plan and Public Health. So then I didn't know where Guam was. I looked at a map.
Right.
And I could hardly find it, you know, that little dinky island in the middle of nowhere. And I said, I can't possibly spend a year there. And so I turned it down. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, we'll get to Guam later.
Okay.
At any rate, I wanted to be close to Philadelphia because that's where I had trained and I had some contacts there, and I had a sick relative, and so I went to the Pentagon to request an assignment at Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I knew there was a neurologist there whose two-year tour was coming up. And they, I knew they needed a neurologist, and I also knew that nobody wanted to go to Fort Dix. It's in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And so I went to the Pentagon and spoke to some of the doctors there who made assignments. And I told them why I wanted to be in Philadelphia at Fort Dix, and I remember exactly what this psychiatrist, the colonel, said. Doctor, that's a quasi-compassionate request for an assignment.
Okay.
And unless someone has a more compassionate request, you'd be going to Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific.
Right.
So I got orders for Fort Knox. And I always wondered why, and I'll get to why I wound up at Fort Knox and somebody else wound up at Fort Dix, which was important because it turned out that the Fort Knox neurologist got sent to Vietnam, and the Fort Dix neurologist got sent with his family to Japan. So that was rather critical, but I didn't know that until later.
Sure.
I got to Fort Knox, and I was the neurologist there. It was a terrific experience. I had two kids.
Mm-hmm.
We were given a house, our first house, and everything was going well. I spent Wednesday in Louisville at the neurology department at the University of Louisville on the faculty teaching, and it was just a terrific experience. And then I got orders to Southeast Asia when I knew it was Vietnam, and that was that. I called my mother. My father had died in 1957.
Okay.
She said, Senator Jacob Javits, who was then the senator from New York, owes us a big favor.
Mm-hmm.
I'll call him and get you out of it.
Right.
And I'm sure she could have.
Mm-hmm.
Because I found out later that political pressure could get somebody out of going to Vietnam.
Sure.
But I said no for a couple of reasons, one of which was I just didn't think it was fair.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was an obligation. I wasn't thrilled about it.
Right.
And also, I remembered something, a quote from Hemingway, that appealed to me. He said, a man, a good man, a real man, must be good with a woman,
mm-hmm.
good with his fists,
mm-hmm.
and good alone in a room with a paper and pencil. Now, I knew I was good alone in a room with a paper and pencil. I was a good writer. I knew I was good with a woman, at least one woman, right, but good with your fists. Well, as a man, I mean, you don't get into fist fights.
Sure.
It was a war. I mean, being a soldier, and I just thought that was sort of complete things, in addition to I felt it was an obligation, and the idea of my not going and some other bloke going and something happening to him was more than I could tolerate. So
right.
I did, I refused my mother's request and wound up going to Vietnam attached to a psychiatric unit.
Mm-hmm.
They were called K teams, capital K dash, and then there was an initial KO team was a neuropsychiatric team. A KB team may have been an orthopedic team or a plastic surgery team or a dental team. And
right.
K teams were attached to either field or evacuation hospitals, major hospitals,
okay.
where they provide specialty care. We went to Valley Forge, Army base in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, for our getting oriented and going through the infiltration course and all those things that I didn't go through because I went right from Yale to Fort Knox, and even now had to wear a uniform, but they taught me. And then we went to Vietnam. There were three psychiatrists, myself, psychiatric nurse, two social workers, a psychologist, and about 15 enlisted personnel.
Okay.
We were rushed there aboard a ship. It took 23 days.
Mm.
It was kind of miserable, but it was 23 days. The only advantage to going by ship is once you get to Vietnam, you've had 23 days into your one-year tour.
Right, right.
The tour started when you left, when we left Long Beach, California.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, on the ship, what do? You play cards, you drink, and get bored. But on the 21st, we were totally incommunicado with the States.
Right.
On the 21st day, we stopped at this most beautiful place I'd ever seen. It was Guam. It looked magnificent, this high mountain, and we pulled in, and I thought, God, I could have spent a year here, and instead spending 24 hours. But one thing about, at Guam, I happened to call my wife and spoke to her for the first time, leaving Long Beach. And then we 2 days, we went through the Philippine Straits and then to Vietnam.
Okay.
We were going to dock at Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Vung Tau, which is the south of Saigon.
Right.
And went up the Saigon River. Now, apparently there were some ships were mined, and so we had to stay in our rooms. We couldn't be on deck. And there were sharpshooters on board the ship, and they were just shooting at everything in the water that moved, like branches and trees, thinking there may be mines. It was kind of a bit unnerving.
Sure.
We got to Saigon in the early evening, and there were about 3,000 troops on the ship, various units. There was a military intelligence unit and other units, and they were all greeted by people, and there were bands and stuff, and all the units were called, and it got to be around midnight, and we were waiting to be called.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't on the list. No one knew we were there, that we were coming, so that was kind of disappointing.
Sure.
All this time, and there was no one waiting for us, so they said, well, we'll put you up in Tent City B.
Mm-hmm.
Tent City B was a place, in, obviously, full of tents where they put stranded soldiers and units that didn't know what to do with. So we got in a deuce and a half, that's a 2.5-ton truck, and got to take us to Tent City.
Mm-hmm.
The driver of the truck, I think he was a sergeant, said, now there's a lot of enemies out in D.C., and sometimes they throw grenades in the truck and stuff, so we want you to get your rifles out and sort of stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And we told them that our rifles were packed.
Right.
Crates. And said, oh, God. Made this comment, my luck, a bunch of cherries and they don't have any weapons.
Right.
And I remember that later on seeing the movie Platoon, and cherries are new soldiers and without weapons. So he gave, he gave me an M16, was unloaded and made me stand up to look like I had a weapon. At any rate, we get to Tent City B, and they put us in rooms, and there was mosquitoes, so we got mosquito nets, but they didn't have posts for the beds.
Mm-hmm.
And a mosquito net is wrapped around a post, but a mosquito net without a post is a sheet that has holes in it.
Right.
We were all sitting up that night. It was awful.
Right.
The next day, we were found. The head of psychiatry, and at that time, neurology was under psychiatry in the military.
Mm-hmm.
The head of psychiatry in Vietnam, a Colonel Gordon, met us and apologized that we weren't met at the ship. They had us coming in a day later.
Ah, I see.
So the officers went with him to a place in Tatsunut, which is the air base where they had headquarters, and talked to us about our assignment. And we, aboard ship, we thought that we were the only real neuropsychiatric unit. I was the first and only neurologist in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to put us in Saigon at the Third Field Hospital.
Right.
The major hospital. We were told we were going to a hospital in the jungle, the 93rd Evacuation Hospital, which is kind of a downer.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Well, we learned, this is, I'm quoting the colonel, that we found out in the Korean War that psychiatric casualties do better if they are hospitalized in a facility that simulated field conditions.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a kid who cracks up, put him into a nice, clean, safe hospital with nurses dressed in white and good food and stuff, there's no motivation whatsoever for him to get better.
Right.
But if you put him in a crummy, dirty hospital with snakes and rats and filth and danger, because there wasn't very much protection for the hospital, the kid's going to feel like he was safer out in the field and want to get better. So there we were. I said, but I'm a neurologist. No, neurologist goes with the psychiatrist. There was no neurologist in Saigon, but the neurosurgeons were in Saigon, and I was a neurologist, and they didn't think it was appropriate to, you know, they wanted to split the neurological talent between Saigon and Long Binh, which was about 30 miles north of Saigon, where our hospital was. It was a rubber plantation that they cleared up, put in the hospital, a prefab aluminum, and they surrounded the hospital with two very interesting facilities. One was a petroleum dump.
Okay.
On the other side was an ammunition dump. And we said, why the heck would put a hospital? Now, the hospital is not a target for the enemy, but the petroleum and ammo dump were.
Sure.
And there you stick a hospital between the two, and we sort of concluded that they put the hospital there to deter the enemy from mortaring the ammo and petroleum dump for fear of hitting the hospital, which would be bad publicity.
Mm.
Well, they did hit the petroleum dump, and we sort of had a bad experience. It only happened once. But I told this story a few months ago at a meeting of intensive care physicians from Iraq, and I mentioned my Vietnam experience, and one of the docs said, you know, that's what they did with us in Iraq.
Huh.
They put a petroleum and ammo dump around the hospital out in the desert, presumably for the same reason. So that's military sort of madness.
Right.
But at any rate, we were there, and that was the 93rd evac. We spent a year there, and my experiences there were numerous, and I published them.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of interesting situations the nurses had a very nice facility that they lived in, and they had a beauty parlor, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And we, the physicians, were treated. We had the worst facilities, the worst shower. The enlisted personnel had it much better than the barracks where the physicians were.
Huh.
Which we thought was rather odd.
Sure.
Officers. At any rate, months later, Colonel David M.C.K. Rioch, R.I.O.C.K., who actually was a brigadier general, I think, career military psychiatrist, came to visit the psychiatric unit.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very famous guy. I'd heard of him. And we talked. He asked us about our patients, et cetera, and we discussed them. And over lunch, he said, well, tell me how things are.
Mm-hmm.
Just how do you feel? So we let out all our frustration and anger about our living quarters, which were better than being out in the field, but everyone around in our facility lived better than we did. And he seemed happy. He had this smile on his face, which seemed odd to us. And he said, I guess you're wondering why I'm pleased by what you're telling me. And we said, yes. They read my study. What study, sir? During the Korean War, I did a study on the effect of morale on performance in all branches of the military,
mm-hmm.
and determined that high morale led to better performance in all branches of the military and in all specialty areas except the medical corps.
Huh.
Doctors are so well trained that how badly they feel, they're going to function optimally. So why, in a limited resource environment, why give anything to the doc?
Oh, good.
And that sort of makes sense.
Right.
For some odd reason.
Uh-huh.
Because he was right.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I found out, you know, when I got back to the States that it wasn't true, that physicians, when I was in academic medicine, that young physicians who were depressed, that, you know, they took care of their patients, but not optimally in the sense that they didn't deliver compassionate care, they delivered care. And I'm sure that what the military did in determining the efficiency of the medical corps was how many patients were seen and what was the mortality rate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no question that no matter how badly a doctor feels, you're going to see everyone that has to be seen, you're going to keep them alive.
Right.
But are you going to be compassionate and really, you know, caring and go the extra mile, which is what a good physician should do? It's difficult to do that if you're feeling poorly and depressed.
Sure.
It's hard to be compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
So that we took very good care of our patients, no matter how poorly we felt.
Mm-hmm.
Other sort of interesting experiences, Colonel Pixley, P-I-X-L-E-Y, was head of medicine in Three Corps.
Okay.
The U.S., South Vietnam, there was I Corps, which was the first, this is Roman numeral. I Corps, 2 Corps, 3 Corps,
sure.
4 Corps, 3 Corps, I Corps was north, 4 Corps was in the Mekong Delta, 3 Corps was our area, which included Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Pixley was an interesting, he later became Surgeon General.
Okay.
He was a pain in the ass. He's dead now, so uh-huh. You know I can say that. he was invited to one of our parties, and the CEO of our hospital was a lieutenant colonel. The guys were dressed in hula costumes, and the CEO dressed in a hula costume, and he was relieved of duty because an officer doesn't do that.
Mm.
But what really got to us was, here we were working our asses off, just taking great care of patients, and there were vehicular accidents. I mean, he got a report that our hospital had more truck and jeep accidents than other hospitals in Three Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So he was preoccupied with that. Not that we were taking good care of our patients. And so he made an order that any time we answered the phone or left the post or came back to the post, we had to say safety first.
Hmm.
So we pick up the phone and say safety first, Dr. Captain Darrow. Or if we leave the post and say safety first, then the sentry would say safety first.
Right.
It's so ridiculous. So our urologist put a condom up, and we posted it in the barracks with safety first, which was really the kind of safety first that we should have practiced, or at least the soldiers.
Sure.
Rather than vehicular accidents. Speaking of condoms.
Yeah.
Whenever you made a diagnosis in the Army then, you had to put LOD yes or LOD no.
Okay.
LOD standing for line of duty.
Okay.
So if you say pneumonia, line of duty yes, meaning it was legitimate, obviously, alcoholic intoxication, head trauma, that would be a line of duty no.
Mm-hmm.
But most things were line of duty. If you're AWOL and got sick, you were line of duty no.
Right.
Well, because of that, during the Korean War, soldiers weren't reporting gonorrhea or venereal diseases, because that was line of duty no.
Mm-hmm.
If you were treated for a line of duty no disorder, the time that you're off duty counted towards your tour, and I think your pay was docked for some reason.
Okay.
So the kids weren't reporting their gonorrhea, so their peckers were dripping, and they wouldn't go in and report it until they really got sick.
Right.
So in their ultimate wisdom, they made gonorrhea line of duty yes. That was fine. It was terrific.
Right.
It made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
However, command units were penalized if they had a high VD rate.
Mm-hmm.
Units were.
Right.
So if, the 1st Division had a higher VD rate than the 25th Division, let's say, the general would get a letter and it would go down and to the sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeants would tell their troopers, we don't want you to report VD.
Right.
We'll take care of it. So what happened was, one other thing that I didn't mention was the Army, in terms of supplies, we got our medical supplies, but other things were down the line. The Air Force and the Navy brought things, and then they took what they wanted and gave the rest to the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have, we didn't have any wood to build things and stuff like that. At any rate, the sergeants would come to us with things that we didn't have, and we'd give them penicillin.
Right.
We traded penicillin to give them, and we told them how to use it to treat gonorrhea.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get wood and alcohol and steaks and various other things that they had that we didn't have. So, therefore, gonorrhea was line of duty, yes, but yet the kids couldn't report it.
Mm-hmm.
The sergeant wouldn't let them, and the sergeants would treat the gonorrhea. That's just sort of some of the madness that occurs in the military.
Sure.
But I do think it was right to make gonorrhea line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right.
Other things, let's see. There was a general who visited us, and not General Riak, but a real three-star general, and
mm-hmm.
he got preoccupied with dust. He was furious that this was during the dry season, and whenever a chopper landed, dust would blow all over the place. The guy seemed, I don't remember his name, but he was more preoccupied with the dust on the compound than anything else.
Right.
It was not very good for our morale. In terms of what his interests were.
Sure.
We love Westmoreland.
Mm-hmm.
He visited us a few times.
Okay.
He just looked immaculate.
Mm-hmm.
He'd come in a chopper, and we were told 15 minutes before he'd landed, the CO of the hospital would get a call that the general's coming, and he'd round up whatever of the doctors were free, and we'd meet him, and he'd come by and shake our hands. And he was, no matter how hot it was, how sweaty we were, he always had a freshly pressed uniform on. We could swear that he had a shower and a cleaning lady or whatever in his helicopter. He changed his clothes every time and had it freshly pressed. He was always cleanly shaven. He was a real gentleman. And we felt that. I got there. I didn't mention Christmas Eve, 1965. We were part of the first 200,000 troops.
Okay.
The morale was exceedingly high in terms of the war. We're not talking about living conditions and stuff, but we felt for sure that we would win.
Sure.
Simply because we would prevail, simply because we had Westmoreland.
Right.
And we loved him. We followed him anywhere. And one of the things we did at night after playing cards and having a few drinks was read about the Civil War. There were a couple of Civil War buffs in our hospital unit, and they had a lot of Civil War books. And one of the things that interested me was General George McClellan, the first general of the Army of the Potomac, was beloved by his soldiers.
Right.
They loved him. They'd follow him anywhere. And in retrospect, Lincoln fired him. In retrospect, he was a freaking disaster.
Yeah.
And I said, could that be Westmoreland? here's this guy we love. No, it couldn't be. Westy. But it turns out in retrospect that he was not a good general, and his strategy of search and destroy was not a very good strategy.
Right.
Putting that aside, that was unfortunate, but we didn't realize that at the time.
Yeah.
And what else? Well, we befriended, our unit was close to a special forces base.
Okay.
And the head of it was Colonel Lee Mize, M-I-Z-E. His first name was Ola, O-L-A. And he was a Congressional Medal of Honor winner.
Oh, okay.
From the Korean War. He came in as an enlisted man and got a battlefield commission and actually won the Congressional Medal of Honor. And if there's the book that lists the stories of all the Congressional Medal of Honor people, and Ola Mize was in there and killed hundreds of Chinese by himself. He was a great guy. And he came, he and several of his officers would spend a lot of time in the doctor's barracks at the hospital. We loved them.
Yeah.
They were so different than we were. I mean, we're reflective and cautious and introspective, and they're tough and they just do things. And we were so polar opposites that we were attracted to them. They were attracted to us in retrospect because we would invite them to our parties with the nurses.
Right.
The only way, round eyes are non-Asian.
Yeah.
And, there are a lot of Asian or Vietnamese prostitutes around. But they like to dance and talk to an American lady.
Right.
The only ones there were the nurses. There weren't any other women in Vietnam, any American women.
Right.
And so to get invited to a party, the doctors would have to invite them, and we would invite them because they were our friends. So that was the usual. We benefited from them just by talking to them and having fun with them and listening to their war stories, and they got to dance with nurses at a party.
Right.
So that worked out well, and I learned. Lee Mize told me there's only three things in life worth doing. Drinking, fighting, and fucking.
Right.
Not really, that stuck with me. Drinking, fighting, and fucking. Unless they were doing one of those three things, they felt unfulfilled. But they were just great. I mean, if there wasn't a special forces, they'd probably be in jail.
Right.
Drinking, fighting, and fucking. They were good. One of the special forces guys, Ski Werbisky, first he was called Ski. I think his first name was. I visit. He died in Laos years later. I found out, and I visited his thing at the wall.
Okay.
He was a wonderful person. And another was I'm blocking on some other people. At any rate, I've kept in touch with a couple of them who survived the war, and they were really good people.
Right.
I want to talk about a couple of patients that were of interest.
Okay.
There was a young fellow from Harlem who was in City College of New York, and his family couldn't afford to send him there, and he got drafted. So unless you were in college or medical school or graduate school, you could get drafted. So he was drafted, and he was pissed off.
Right.
I mean, here he was, the kids with money, the white kids with money, didn't go in, and he was, I think he was half Puerto Rican, half African-American.
Yeah.
He was upset. Well, he landed, he was flown to Vietnam, and he had Tonsonute Air Base in Saigon, and got in line where a sergeant asked him his name, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the sergeant said, "What's your name, son?" And he writes down his name.
Yeah.
He said, "Well, what is it?" And he writes down, "I'm not speaking, I'm just writing."
Mm-hmm.
"Why?" He said, "Because I feel like it." So this was really, the sergeant didn't know what the hell was doing. So he put him off to the side until the line was over, and then called over his superior, and he just said, "I'm not speaking, I'm just writing, and I'll tell you anything you want." So they didn't know what to do with him, so they sent him to us, the neuropsychiatric unit, because there wasn't a neurologist in Saigon, and actually there wasn't an otolaryngologist, an ENT doctor, and so I, a neurologist, was the only doctor in Vietnam with tuning forks, so they made me the consultant otolaryngologist because I could check for hearing, even though I wasn't an otolaryngologist. Anyhow, I established that he could hear, and we established that he could talk but wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So he was admitted to the hospital.
Right.
And a very young psychiatrist was an OJT psychiatrist, that stands.
Mm-hmm.
An OJT was an on-the-job training.
Right.
The kid wanted to, he finished medical school, his father was a psychiatrist. He wanted to be a psychiatrist, so they trained him for 6 months and sent him over to us as a psychiatrist, which was fine.
Mm-hmm.
He was good, but he knew more psychiatry than any of us except the real psychiatrist. So he was taking care of this kid, and making rounds in the morning was very interesting. He'd come up to him and say, "How you doing, son?" And the kid would say, "Fine. Anything bothering you?" "No." And they'd tap carrot. Now, you can imagine how frustrating it is to carry on a conversation when the response is in writing.
Sure.
Because you have to wait for him to write it, then you have to read it, then you have to say. And so then in the middle, after around 15 minutes, he'd write, "That's it for today, sir. See you tomorrow." And give him the note, and that's it. He wouldn't even write anymore. They didn't know what the hell to do with this.
Right.
So I, the neurologist, came up with the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Let's utilize his being quiet and make use of it." When does being quiet have survival value?
Uh-huh.
Well, either as being a forward artillery observer, being way out in the, calling in artillery and getting hit by short rounds,
mm-hmm.
or a point man in a rifle platoon.
Right.
Where you're out several hundred yards ahead of your platoon, so if there's enemy or mines or something, they know it because you're blown up.
Yeah.
And you want to be quiet out there.
Right.
So we sent him to his unit, which was the first the big red one, the first division,
mm-hmm.
with
right.
a note saying, "He's not speaking, but he doesn't have any physical illness, there's no disease. It's command responsibility as to what assignment he should have, but we suggest that he be a permanent appointment. He started to talk. That was kind of cute and nice. And I don't know whatever happened to him, but I think it was probably maturational that he grew up.
Right.
We had another kid. Now, this is interesting, another sort of paradox of military assignment. Who grew up with a sort of a rescue fantasy. A rescue fantasy is someone who's so compassionate that they spend their life helping people and things. If there was a stray dog or cat, he'd bring him home. If he saw a bird with a broken leg, he'd splint the leg and take care of the bird. It was that kind of life that he had.
Right.
And he married a young woman with severe multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. I mean, she needed total care. She was totally disabled, mm-hmm. which was part of his pattern as a caring person. Well, he gets drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he could have gotten out of it because he was married with a disabled spouse. I mean, without question, he could have gotten out of the draft, but he didn't.
Sure.
So he goes through basic training, and he applies for a position as a chaplain's assistant, mm-hmm. which would have been terrific. Instead, they made him a rifleman.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets sent to Vietnam. He was in the 1st Division as well. And he's out there in firefights. He was petrified about the idea of killing somebody.
Right.
So he would shoot high.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever they were in a firefight, he would aim high so he wouldn't have to shoot anyone.
Right.
His unit, he got separated from his unit once, and he wound up in a clearing by himself. And at the other end of the clearing, this Viet Cong soldier, who was also by himself, came out, and there they were, facing each other. And they both reflexly pulled their rifle toward each other, pulled the trigger, and our guy prevailed and killed the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
It was a reflex response due to his training.
Sure.
And he survived, and it was great, but he was incredibly depressed that he killed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of days later, he's on a deuce and a half truck, and it hits a mine.
Okay.
Explosion. He wakes up on the ground. He was unconscious. He wakes up, and he hears Vietnamese chatter and gunshots.
Mm.
He turns his head, and he sees that the truck is blown up, all his buddies are on the ground, and these Viet Cong soldiers are going around determining who was alive, and anyone who was alive, they shot.
Hmm.
So he had to play dead.
Right.
Petrified.
Mm-hmm.
His back was killing him. He knew something was wrong with his back, but of course he couldn't move. At any rate, this Viet Cong approaches him, he hears his footsteps, and he's just expecting to get killed. And then his back started hurting more, and he realized that the guy was doing something to his back.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know what it was. And then after around 15 minutes, the guy leaves. And when the soldier felt it was safe, he sees that the Viet Cong are gone. All his buddies are dead. And he puts his hand in his back, and there's a bandage.
Huh.
He had a back wound, and this guy bandaged his wound.
Hmm.
He came up against a compassionate Viet Cong.
That's...
And here, you know, he's feeling guilty as hell for shooting one of them.
Right.
So he had to. So, he goes to the hospital, and his wound is taken care of. And then when he's about to be discharged, he develops a trigger finger of his right index finger. Now, that's when your finger is closed like you pull the trigger, but you can't open it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a not uncommon malingering, factitious, psychogenic disturbance.
You know, okay.
A trigger finger. There's no reason why he couldn't open his... But that, if you can't open your middle finger, you can't carry a rifle.
Right.
And so they realized that. He was at the 3rd Field Hospital in Saigon. And they realized, you know, they sent him up to us, the psychiatric facility. Well, when we found out, we got this history of this poor kid who shouldn't have been in the Army. to begin with and should have been a chaplain's assistant and not a rifleman because of his orientation. You know, we sent him back to Saigon as a postal clerk and spent the rest of his tour there. But the idea, I mean, that was an incredible experience for me, and the idea that they would indeed make a rifleman out of this kid who was obvious, should have been a chaplain's assistant, was one of the curious things about the military, which then takes me to why I wound up at Fort Knox and not at Fort Dix.
Okay.
Despite my quasi-compassionate request for an assignment at Fort Dix. I took a wounded soldier, accompanied him to Japan for care. We would take soldiers that we couldn't care for, send them either to the Philippines or Japan or back to the U.S., where they'd get the kind of specialty care we couldn't offer. And if they were really sick and needed physician care aboard the plane, we would accompany them. So I made this trip to Japan with a soldier and wound up talking to a neurologist there who was there with his family and living in a nice house on a military base. And I said, well, you know, where were you stationed in the U.S.? And he said, Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was the guy who went to Fort Dix.
Right.
And I wondered, what did you tell them, you know, to get you to Fort Dix? He said, what did I tell them? I said, I went there, and I said, you know, I was born and raised in New York. I went to school in New York, went to med school in New York, did my training in New York. When I leave the Army, I'm going to practice in New York. I've never been to any other part of the United States. Send me anywhere except Fort Dix. That's exactly what he told them. And he gets to Fort Dix, which means I have to go someplace else. I get to Fort Knox. That's okay, except the Fort Knox neurologist, and it wasn't Bob Darrow, me, it was the Fort Knox neurologist gets sent to Vietnam because they didn't need, and the Fort Dix neurologist got sent to Japan. The reason why, and I got sent before he did, because Fort Knox neurologist was in a base closest to a civilian facility with a neurologist.
Mm.
That was Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really need me as much as they needed a neurologist at Fort Dix, so I got sent. At any rate, that kind of assignment led to my going to Vietnam rather than New Jersey and Tokyo, and in a sense it led to this conversation we're having. But in retrospect, you know, it was an exceedingly maturational experience for me. I learned how to, well, I developed a great appreciation for the military and for my colleagues. And one other, let's see, yeah, how did we feel about the enemy when I was talking about the Viet Cong? It wasn't much about the war when in late 1965, you know, we knew the college kids were protesting, but they're always protesting. And we didn't have any negative feelings about the VC, except when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
We went into the hospital and saw all these teenage or young 20s wounded American boys.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody evil must have done this to them.
Right.
And suddenly, the Viet Cong became evil to us. Now, the fact that we were 8,000 miles away from home in their country was, you know, our mindset was such that we were doing the right thing because these people were evil.
Right.
That was that. Whether the domino theory which got us there was correct is open for discussion. And indeed, there's a book, Vietnam, The Necessary War, which makes the case that if it wasn't for our years in Vietnam, it led to the fall of the Soviet Union, ultimately.
Right.
He makes that case. Well, it's hard to, history, you can't go back. But it made sense at the time because the domino theory was the prevalent theory, and this was part of it. Mm-hmm. Where were you going to draw the line? After Vietnam, I had 6 months left in the military, and the one good thing was that if you had a two-year tour and you left Vietnam, you could pick your assignment. I was going to be spending a year at the University of California, San Francisco, in fellowship.
Okay.
Starting in July of 67. So my January through June of 67, I requested Letterman Army Hospital in Presidio in San Francisco, and I spent 6 months there, and that was a very good experience. That was a plus. As I think in retrospect, the entire experience in Vietnam and in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So, I spent 20, I've been in academic medicine since then after the military, my fellowship in San Francisco, and then I spent 12 years on the faculty of the University of Miami in neurology and ophthalmology because my fellowship was in neuro-ophthalmology, and then I came to Cleveland in 1980 as chairman of the Department of Neurology. And I speak often about Vietnam and military experience. I've written a number of papers, four papers on cerebral malaria, which was the only English language papers written on cerebral malaria since World War II. It was the last time that American soldiers were faced with it. And one other thing, yes, I actually spent, I retired from the VA where I was part-time for over 25 years.
Okay.
In academic VAs, and I still make rounds weekly at the VA hospital here in Cleveland, and I wear some Vietnam service ribbons so that the vets, you know, it's not a we they situation. They see that I was one of them.
Right.
And one of the things, one of the ribbons I wear, it's a little metal thing that says door gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why do I have door gunner?
Right.
Well, I was a psychiatrist, and I were sent to Anke, which was the home of the first cath, first air cath, and a court-martial. We were testifying. A kid got drunk, and he shot a major. And there was, so we were testifying at this court-martial as to whether he had a psychiatric condition. But military court-martials, if you are testifying, you can't be in the courtroom when other people are testifying.
Okay.
So there we were in this place. There wasn't anything there. It was just miles and miles of tents. And we had nothing to do for a couple of days because we weren't on to testify. And this was, I think, in February of 66, and neither of us had been in the helicopter. So they were making about every half hour a helicopter went around the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the helicopter base asking whether we could take a ride on it, ride around the perimeter. And the sergeant said, "Boy, I'm glad you guys are here. We're missing two door gunners on a combat mission. Are you willing to go on it?"
Huh.
Well, we, knew he was just joking. I mean, we are two captain medical corps officers. He wants to send us on a combat mission. He's going to think we're going to say hell no and get out of there. Then they'll have this great laugh of these chicken shit doctors.
Right.
Didn't want to. So we said sure. Next thing we knew, we were indeed each of us on a gunner, a door gunner on this damn mission.
Right.
And the pilot. The one I was on was very, very thankful. Boy, I'm glad we got you here. Thanks for volunteering. He showed me how to use the machine gun and strapped me in. And then he takes off, and I was on the right side, and he banks right so that I'm almost, there I was, looking down and trying to brace myself. I knew he did that on purpose. Thinking I was going to fall out.
Sure.
So I was strapped in, but there was about a 15-foot lead between the strap attached to me and the hook on the helicopter. I just imagined myself down there, just sort of hanging, waving, trying to get someone's attention. He did it, I think, so that I would learn how to balance myself, which I did. And after I got comfortable, I actually wanted to see action.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to discuss that any further.
Right.
Other than, and there's a lot of literature written about that,
mm-hmm.
the circumstance you're in is not your genetic makeup. If you get put in an action circumstance, you're going to want it. And there have been various studies of college kids who adopted the role of a police officer, let's say, and they were cruel, or prison guards. They were cruel to other college kids who were making believe they were prisoners, and various things like giving electroshock treatment to friends and things like that. If you're given an order, you follow it.
Right.
And here I was, a gunner, and that's what I'm supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not just look pretty up there.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to get into that any further.
But sure.
I learned something about myself and about human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And human nature is that men are warriors. And it was Plato who said a few thousand years ago, only the dead have seen the end of war.
Right.
Right on. At the end of World War I, the League of Nations formed a commission to study why war, so that this would be the end of all wars. And they asked Einstein to interview Sigmund Freud to find out why people fight and what can we do to get this war mentality out of the human race.
Right.
And his response was, you can't.
Yeah.
And he wrote this essay, Why War? It is human nature. Men are going to fight with other men, either because of different religions or different colors, or they live in different places.
Mm-hmm.
That's just it, period, pure and simple.
Right.
Well, that's that. I'm very, very impressed with your facility in Lubbock and all that you've done to keep the memories of the forgotten heroes. And I don't regard myself as a hero, but what really sort of pisses me off was how when our kids came back, they were treated so poorly.
Yes, sir.
By the neighbors and stuff. You know, it was just, they were kind of like pariahs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the war was so unpopular.
Right. Right.
And then came Ted and the general disillusionment.
Yeah.
Even though, in retrospect, we prevailed in Ted.
Right.
So, that's it. I responded to your question.
Yes, sir.
And I'm sure you have specifics.
All right.
Maybe not.
Well, I do, but a lot of it you've already covered. You covered pretty well. But I did have a few other general questions that I wanted to ask you.
Uh-huh.
But looking back on your experience with Vietnam, what do you think about American involvement?
I'm ambivalent.
Mm-hmm.
If the guy who wrote Vietnam, the Necessary War, was correct, it was the right thing to do. We don't know. If it wasn't Vietnam, it was going to be Thailand and the Philippines. And, you know, if indeed John Foster Dulles and everybody since then up through past Nixon believed that, you know, the domino theory was correct, then we had to take a stand at some point.
Mm.
And it's my understanding from reading a General Jopp, and I, you know, remind me to get back to General Jopp.
Okay.
That they did plan to go, if it was Vietnam, then Laos, Cambodia, which they had, Thailand, and then the Philippines, Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan. They didn't mention Australia and New Zealand,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I think that would have, you know, that was the domino theory, and at least we delayed it such that, according to current thinkers, historians, it led to the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. So if that's correct, fine. Now, if it turns out that, and the fact is that we didn't fight the war correctly.
Right.
You know, a war of attrition. That's what we were doing. It was the body count. The soldiers went out on search and destroy, and they'd come back with a list of not a list of how many did you kill today? I killed 20. I killed 15. They didn't know how many they killed.
Yeah.
But you know, they were just shooting, and it was it just that wasn't the way to fight it. We did not. We didn't really build up the indigenous South Vietnamese, their morale and their fighting force, and we thought we'd win the war ourselves and give it back to them, but we didn't.
Right.
Now, General Jacques.
Yeah.
I left Vietnam in December of 66, and I think it was in 1984. In the early 80s, I met a Vietnamese-American neurologist, Daniel Truong, T-R-U-O-N-G,
okay,
who trained in he was a Vietnamese physician who moved to the United States and did his neurologic training at the Medical University of South Carolina. And I was visiting professor there in the early 80s. And, you know, he found out I was in Vietnam, and he sort of became, I adopted him. I had gave him advice over the years, and I think it was in 2005, he organized groups of neurologists and other physicians to go to Vietnam and give lectures.
Okay.
He was a Vietnamese neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I was back in Vietnam, and we were in Saigon, and I went, I drove past where our hospital, 93rd Evacuation Hospital, was in Long Binh.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Long Binh, after I was there, became headquarters of U.S. Army Vietnam, was all built up. But when I was there,
right,
there was only the hospital, the ammunition dump, the petroleum jump, and LBJ, which was the Long Binh jam.
Right.
It later became the major headquarters for U.S. Army Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But we drove there, and then I got really nervous the first time, and I did with the first visit, because if I saw the hospital, you know, it brought back this feeling. I didn't realize it, but when I look at pictures of myself and my fellow officers that we took, we were all depressed.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, you know, we were all down in the dumps. We worked our asses off, but our morale was pretty low, and we were down in the dumps, and I suddenly felt this wave of dysphoria as we were approaching where our hospital was located. And then I saw an industrial park that stretched out for miles.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing that looked anything like our hospital or the petroleum dump or the ammo dump or the Long Binh jail. It was just this huge industrial park. So that ended the experience.
Mm-hmm.
It ended it.
Right.
And I felt comfortable again. Which leads me to another free association. Over the years, after returning to the States, I would periodically get this, suddenly, without any reason, a sense of dysphoria, sort of feeling down in the dumps, which would clear in an hour or two. I didn't associate it with anything until we got a helicopter pad in our hospital to bring in patients from outlying areas, and I realized that when I hear the sound of the helicopter, that's what brought on this feeling.
Huh.
Because in Vietnam, in our hospital unit, all day long, we were hearing choppers landing and taking off.
Sure.
And I was feeling poorly, not because of the choppers, but because of just being there away from my family. And that triggered the dysphoria back in the States, and I then realized, and then I got over it.
Right.
Well, in one of the trips that I made in recent years, and we went to Hanoi, as well as Saigon, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City, they arranged for me to meet General Jacques.
Oh, wow.
IAP, who was the commanding general.
Right.
Of the North Vietnamese. And he was 95 years old. I think it was in December of 2005 that I met him. Daniel Truong had actually seen him medically, and Daniel was well connected with Vietnamese politicians and things.
Mm-hmm.
I was to meet General Jacques. We were taken there the morning after I arrived in Hanoi, Daniel Truong was doing the translating, and there was a Vietnamese politician and a Vietnamese entrepreneur who drove us in his big Mercedes to General Giap's villa in Hanoi.
Right.
We were taken to a room and waited for the general.
Yeah.
Then taken to his meeting room, which was had a big conference table and pictures of him all over the place and various Vietnamese flags. His picture with Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah.
And he came in, age 95, and I saluted him. And, he had known that I served with the U.S. forces. He asked that I sit next to him. And Daniel Truong was, I don't know if General Giap speaks English or not, but he didn't. Daniel introduced me as the second coming of Hippocrates, you know, the world's greatest physician.
Right.
So General Giap replied in Vietnamese, which Daniel translated. Dr. Daroff, I believe that in your presence, my brain is getting bigger. So I had to respond. So I said, General Giap, I believe that you were the greatest general since, and then I didn't know whether to go back to Alexander the Great or Hannibal or Genghis Khan, but I decided to be modern. I said, in the last, you were the greatest general in the last 300 years.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I disagree. And I thought, well, he was brought up under the French. I knew he was a student of military history. I said, well, perhaps only secondary to Napoleon.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I was not inferior to Napoleon. And then I said, and then my wife thinks that this was my greatest remark that I ever made. I said, General, I agree. Napoleon was defeated by Wellington at Waterloo, and you never lost the defining battle.
Right.
And he smiled, and that was the end of that conversation. Now, this was a guy who drove out the French. He drove out the Americans. He drove out the Chinese who invaded after we left.
Right.
He may have been the greatest general that ever lived. I don't know. But
yeah.
He was a little, very impressive guy in a full uniform.
Yeah.
Now, I had this book, a book about General Giap, and I wanted him to inscribe it. So I pushed the book over to him. And Daniel Truong said he wants you to inscribe the book. And he takes the book and moves it over away from me and says, thank you for the gift of the book. And Daniel said to him, well, he's not giving you the book. He's just wants you. And he says, thank you for the gift of the book. And so Daniel thought that he was demented. And then he inscribes the book, and I'm going to find the book if I can.
Okay.
And the inspiration, which I will find it. Well, at any rate, I can't. Yeah, I've got it.
Okay.
Now, he inscribes the book in Vietnamese, and I guess, and it's translated, and then Daniel translates it, and it says, friendly gift to the Honorable Daroff. I wish the Honorable good health, and to bring the scientific achievement in neurology to a higher peak than it currently exists.
Mm-hmm.
And try with all your efforts to help Vietnam and contribute to the friendship of the people of Vietnam and the people of the United States. Vietnam, 30 November 2005. He signs his name, Senior General of the Army, Vo Nguyen Giap.
Hmm.
That was just incredible.
Sure.
And he gave it to me as a gift. Now, he wanted to give me a gift.
Right.
How could he give me the book? And he didn't have a gift. So he accepts the book as a gift and then gives it back to me. That's a general.
Right.
He's like a chess player. He's thinking ahead. I want to give this young doctor a gift. I'll accept the book and then give it back to him as a gift, which was marvelous.
Right. Yes, sir.
Now, it turns out, you know, it was a very nice meeting and a very nice inscription. The Vietnamese people like the Americans. They love us. They hate the French.
Right.
You know, the French were conquerors. They were occupiers. They sort of realize now that they just got caught in the middle of an East-West power struggle.
Right.
And we didn't, you know, we weren't interested in occupying. We were just sort of doing what our strategists thought we had to do. So they hold no grudge and they like us. And they're very pleasant people.
Right. Yes, sir.
All right. What do you have? Any more questions?
Well, one thing I want to ask, how many times have you been back?
Four times in 5 years or five times in 4 years. I did one or the other. But I haven't been back in 2 years.
Okay. Now, I've heard people say that every time they go back, it's changed. It gets more and more modern. Is that the case?
More and more modern. I mean, there's more and more hotels. It's just incredible.
Uh-huh.
It's just really, you know, it's remarkable what they've done. You know, it really is a thriving area, and I think that it's a major tourist attraction.
Right.
Lots of Americans, lots of Germans, even the French. I guess they're kind to the French, even though they don't like them. You know, they just want money.
Right. Sure. All right. Well, one other thing I wanted to ask you, going back a little bit to your Vietnam experience and the 935th Medical Detachment, could you tell me a little bit more about outside of, I know you mentioned car accidents and VD, but can you tell me a little bit about other things that you guys were treating?
Well, the psychiatrists were getting referrals of
sure
kids who were depressed or anxious or nervous or crazy.
Mm-hmm.
If they were crazy, meaning schizophrenic or severely depressed, they got sent back to the States.
Okay.
Otherwise, they got sent back to their unit.
Right.
You know, anxiety wasn't enough to keep you out of fighting. They're all anxious. And I was seeing neurologic, you know, first of all, determining for the psychiatrist if someone, let's say, had a trigger finger, whether or not it was real or whether it was psychogenic. So I would determine that they didn't have brain disease, structural brain disease. But I also was seeing wounds and people passing out and people with bad headaches. The things that, it turns out, that I was seeing the things that neurologists at military bases in the U.S. see.
Okay.
Plus cerebral malaria and other tropical diseases, plus gunshot wounds.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about cerebral malaria?
Well, malaria is... Did I send you any articles on it?
Yes, you did, but just for the record.
Malaria can be mild or bad, and bad malaria is, in which it doesn't respond and which makes people very, very sick, involves the brain.
Uh-huh.
And it can vary from being mild and sort of have a bad headache and being forgetful to being comatose.
Right.
And dying. And we saw 18 cases during that year. When I got there, which was 2 weeks or so after the unit, the main hospital unit of the 93rd Evac had arrived, and they had two deaths from cerebral malaria during those 2 weeks before I got there.
Uh-huh.
And they said, oh, boy, we're glad to have a neurologist. We've had two deaths from cerebral malaria.
Right.
Hell, I'd never heard of cerebral malaria. So, you know, I reviewed the records and, you know, what they had given these kids who died, and the only thing they hadn't given them was cortisone, corticosteroids, and so I decided that, well, the next one that comes in, we're going to treat with cortisone as well as the anti-malarial drugs, and we had 18 out of 18 survive, and that then became standard of care throughout the whole Vietnam. All the hospitals used that protocol, and there wasn't a single death of an American or soldier from cerebral malaria during the whole war.
Oh, wow.
Now, that was terrific, and I wrote the paper up, and it was the lead article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And then in the early 80s, there was an article in New England Journal saying that steroids don't help cerebral malaria. They make it worse.
Huh.
And then the Tropical Medicine Club, these are people, you know, they kind of resented me because I wasn't in their club, and here I was, you know, treating tropical there's a number of articles written by tropical medicine doctors saying that steroids, corticosteroids, cortisone derivatives,
right,
add to morbidity but don't improve mortality.
Mm.
So it's bad. Well, none of them, but they were treating children and malnourished indigenous Africans and Asians, and they weren't treating American soldiers,
right,
or any civilian population who was ordinarily in good health.
Right.
They were using primarily experiences in children and saying that malaria shouldn't be true. Cerebral malaria shouldn't be treated with corticosteroids. The military is still doing it, and I mean, we realize that if an American soldier or any adult in good general health who's well nourished should be given corticosteroids if they get cerebral malaria.
Okay.
But that's a battle I'm not going to win.
Right, yes, sir. All right. Well, now, this time, were you treating only Americans or were allied forces as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, allied, yeah. Since I was the only neurologist, I saw a handful of Koreans and a number of Australians and several Vietnamese general officers.
Okay.
South Vietnamese general officers, not ordinary troops. And we made some, depending upon, you know, a lot of my colleagues went to Vietnamese civilian hospitals, mm-hmm, and, you know, made rounds there. I did a couple of times,
right,
and assisted them. But they were allied forces.
Okay. All right. What was your opinion of the South Vietnamese?
When I was there?
Yes, sir.
You know, it wasn't positive.
Mm-hmm.
Not of their army. I mean, can I talk army talk to you?
Sure.
Why are there such good fighters and are such crummy fighters?
Right.
You know, that was sort of that's the GI lingo. You mean,
right,
Vietnam's were good fighters and ours, you know, it obviously had to do with morale, and they had a cause and our guys didn't.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Okay. Well, what about enemy soldiers? Did you treat them as well?
Yes.
Okay.
When they were brought in. Now, they were brought in by our soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
If an Arvin, a South Vietnamese soldier, had a wounded enemy, they would not bring him to us. They'd bring him to either one of their hospitals or shoot them, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But if one of our soldiers had an enemy wounded, they'd bring him to us, and we'd take damn good care of them.
Right.
We take as good a care of them as we did of our own soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
But once they were stabilized, they were taken by the Arvin to one of their hospitals, and what happened to them, I don't know.
Right.
But when they were in our care, they got the best care we could deliver. That is the code of military, you know, that's the medical code.
Right.
And that's part of a lecture I give on medical professionalism,
uh-huh,
that no matter, you know, that there's no enemy when you have a sick person.
Mm-hmm.
You treat them like, right, you would treat your own. And the sicker, and if there's a bunch of people in the waiting room, you take care of the sickest first, whether the sickest is an enemy or one of your own.
Right. Okay. All right, let's see. What else here? Could you take me through just a typical day, if there was such a thing, with the 935th?
Well, a typical day was you'd get up and you'd shower and, you know, have a crummy breakfast. All the meals were the same. That's the damnedest thing. They all tasted the same.
Right.
I mean, eggs looked like eggs and meat looked like meat. but they all tasted the same. It was incredible. It was just, so the food was awful. And I had gustatory, that taste, gustatory, medical term for taste.
Right.
Gustatory deprivation. I really wanted to taste something. Some guys had, you know, women deprivation, and they'd go into Saigon and you know, get laid.
Right.
I'd go in every weekend that I wasn't on call or something. I'd drive in a Jeep to have a pizza pie at a French pizza parlor, which opened, you know, on Saturday evenings, just to have something to eat.
Right.
That had a taste. And we would drive back through enemy territory between Longbin and Saigon. They had control, the Viet Cong had control of the roads at night. So there would be Jeeps blown up and stuff like that, but I was willing to take that chance that with a bunch of my buddies that we'd have our weapons. I had a .45, which I couldn't shoot worth a damn, but I had a shotgun, which I traded for some, for a fan. I mean, we're talking about barter.
Right.
We traded our nurses for a couple of fans, and I had two fans, and I gave one to a Special Forces sergeant. He said, what do you want for it? I said, what do you have? He said, I'll give you a Nikon. I said, I have a Nikon. So I said, well, how about a rifle? He said, yeah, you want a shotgun? Yeah. So anyhow, I got the shotgun around, so at least if I did confront the enemy, I'd have a fighting chance.
Sure.
With my .45. But the food was awful, and so I would take this chance most weekends to get a pizza in Saigon. Even something like Vienna sausage, which is kind of yucky.
Right.
I loved it. Someone would bring in Vienna sausage because it had taste and our food didn't. Anyhow, we'd have food, and then I'd go to my clinic, and just patients would just roll in. They'd come in from various, you know, they'd be flown in because I was the only neurologist, or from the by ambulance or jeep from the military units that were stationed nearby, and then if I had hospitalized patients, I'd see them. And that would be the end of the day, and then I'd have dinner, which tasted like breakfast, and I'd shower again. And we'd watch a movie, a war movie. They'd always show these damn war movies. Outside, rain or shine, and it rained 6 months. Didn't rain for 6 months, but we'd be out there watching a movie. And if we get called in because of a patient, we wouldn't watch the movie. We'd go in and have a drink and play poker or something.
Mm-hmm.
Read. Go to sleep.
Right.
That was that.
Okay.
Pretty damn boring. Except... we were taking care of kids.
Yes, sir. All right. Did you participate in any civic action programs or anything?
No.
Okay. All right.
I visited a few whenever we traveled. You know, I visited a civilian hospital and gave some advice, but never on a regular basis. Other doctors did.
Okay. All right. Did you have a chance to go on R&R?
Yes. I made, let's see. I had 2 weeks leave and I think a week's R&R. My 2 weeks leave, I met my wife in Japan. That was wonderful.
Right.
So I spent 2 weeks with her. My mother took care of my kids, and she met me in Japan. That was a leave, and then R&R, I went to Hong Kong, which was nice.
Okay. All right. Well, one other thing I wanted to ask you. Did you see any medical issues when it came to concerning with Agent Orange or anything?
Agent Orange, I saw no... when I came back to the States, then Agent Orange sort of got popularized.
Right.
I've spent over 25 years at the VA hospitals in Miami and in Cleveland, and I didn't see anything that looked like could be due to Agent Orange. And indeed, when the lawsuit occurred, the class action lawsuit, and I was a member of the class, being a veteran.
Sure.
Suing the drug companies. I happened to be one of three neurologists who represented the defense, represented the drug companies.
Okay.
In the Agent Orange situation, and I examined all the representatives of the class. That is, those soldiers who the plaintiff's attorneys felt best represented Agent Orange toxicity, and none of them had anything that resembled Agent Orange.
Huh.
Our conclusion was there's no neurologic problem related to Agent Orange, period.
Okay.
Now, over the years, you know, I don't know, I haven't kept up with it as to whether kidney, you know, as we age, there are all sorts of things, and now Agent Orange is felt to be responsible for a number of conditions.
Sure.
It wasn't responsible for any of the neurologic conditions during the Agent Orange litigation.
Okay.
And I believe in my article on neurology in the combat zone, I summarize in a couple of paragraphs that experience.
Okay. All right. Well, I think you've covered things pretty well here.
Well, you were terrific. Will you send me how this can be accessed once it's started?
Sure, absolutely. And
my kids see it.
Yeah. Let me go ahead and stop the recording, and we can talk for just a
moment. Okay.